with polio and not the polio vaccine. And then I remember the house fire that took the lives of Anna's parents a year before her suicide. That unsolved house fire. And this makes me recall that Uncle Bert never mentioned water in that deep lake of his. And that's when I began to hear the gnashing of teeth. Stay with me. The whole bunch sets upon me and I scrabble backward, but it is no use. Anna is first to grab me, and she doesn't look young anymore. She looks dead. She grabs me by the hair, and Tracker dives toward my groin with his teeth bared. I move quickly to my left to avoid the hound's terrible bite, but I lose my footing, and I'm surrounded by a circle of the damned. Some guy who is a dead ringer for old Jack appears, and he smiles, and then raises up that Louisville slugger and brings it straight down, quickly and violently and directly, at my heart. I open my eyes and cough deep red blood onto the white snow. Adam Egan is directly above me, his sweat pouring onto me as he brings his entire weight down through the palms of his hands to the center of my chest. Chapter 38, Fired from Update. Norm, I told you this when I first spoke to you 4 years ago. It is imperative that you always have an exit strategy. But I don't want to leave, Lorne. I'm happy where I am, sitting behind a desk, reading from cue cards that are placed 2 feet in front of my face. I like working 10 minutes a week, and I don't plan on going anywhere. Besides, I just finished shooting a film. Don't you want a big-time movie star reading the news? Well, when you leave is not your decision, Norm. It's not? It had never occurred to me that it wouldn't be my decision when I left the show. I had long ago decided that I would spend my entire career on SNL, but had forgotten to inform Lorne about it. But if it wasn't my decision, then whose could it be? Are you telling me that you don't like me, Lorne? It's out of my hands, Norm, but I know Don wants to talk to you. Don was Don Ohlmeyer, the head of all the entertainment shown on NBC. I'd never met him, but I knew he lived in Los Angeles and had an office there, and brown hair. Why does he want me out, Lorne? He won't tell me. Don believes that it's cowardly to deliver such news over the phone, so we're flying you out to Los Angeles. The plane leaves within the hour. Next thing I knew, I was sitting in the great man's office. Norm, are you aware that I am very good friends with O.J. Simpson? Oh, yes, sir, I am. And I know I've been pretty hard on him on Update. I apologize for that. I guess where the blame really lies is in my institutionalized racism. Oh, no, Norm, you don't understand. I never had a problem with the jokes. I love them. I just noticed that about 6 months ago, you stopped doing them. You never bring O.J. up at all anymore. Well, Don, that's because a jury of his peers found Mr. Simpson not guilty of all charges filed against him. He's as innocent as you or me. If I was to mention O.J. at all on the telecast, it would be to deliver a profound and heartfelt apology for the cruel, racist remarks I made in my self-appointed role as judge, jury, and executioner. Norm, I've known O.J. for many years. He's a close friend. I visited him in prison every Monday morning, and you know how I'd greet him, Norm? No, sir, I don't. Well, I'd give him the business about this whole double murder thing. Lay a couple of zingers on him from your Update segment. Boy, old O.J. would see red, I'm here to tell you. And the more esteemed he got, the funnier it struck me. Oh, well, it's nice to know you like the joke, sir. Well, there's the rub, son, said Don. Ever since he's been acquitted, he and I golf over at Brentwood. We have a standing tea time every Monday at 6 a.m. Problem is, you've decided to stop doing jokes about him, and I don't have anything to zing him with. You follow? Sir, I hope you're not asking me to do what I think you are. If you want to save your job, Norm, get back to the O.J. jokes. You promise me that, and I promise that you can have Update as long as you like. I don't think I could do that, sir. What about the jury system and fair play and all that? Oh, come on, Norm. O.J. can take a joke. They're all meant in good fun, and I'm just a guy who works hard trying to make the TV viewers happy. Heck, the only kicks I get are when I can give my friend O.J. Simpson the business. Now, you wouldn't want to take that away from me, would you? I'll have to think about it, sir. But there wasn't a lot to think about. I flew back to New York and talked with Lori, Joe, Downey, Frank, and Ross. We all agreed that what we had done to O.J. had been unconscionable. We had been mostly fueled by my lifelong institutionalized racism. Now that we'd woken up to that fact, to continue to make O.J. jokes while the real killers were at large was out of the question. And for what? So Don Ohlmeyer could get under his pal's skin at the Brentwood Country Club? The only thing O.J. Simpson was guilty of was being the best running back in history. And while O.J. Simpson had proven himself to be the greatest rusher, I had proven myself to be the greatest rusher to judgment. Chapter 39, A Debt Incurred. It happened the night I was fired from Update. I wasn't a compulsive gambler at the time, but within 24 hours I would be. I was feeling low after the program ended, while my friends waved at the studio audience and held up little pictures for people they knew were watching TV. Adam Egan and I raced down the New Jersey Turnpike, and it was black, except for the stars in the sky and the eyes of the deer on the highway side. We hit Atlantic City at dawn. The casino sat square in the center of the squalid streets, streets lined with boarded-up houses and stores with signs that read, "We pay cash for gold fillings," and the dangerous poor, with nothing to lose but their lousy, stinking, hopeless lives, and nothing of value but the gold in their teeth. It was Sunday morning, and instead of a church, Adam Egan and I were checking into the Devil's House, the Tropicana Casino and Resort. Gambling addiction is a disease for sure, but it's the only disease that can make you very wealthy. Osteoarthritis ain't going to make you dime one, friend. Just ask my Aunt Gertrude. However, gambling addiction can also be a fatal disease. When a doctor tells you that you have 6 months to live, he's making an educated guess. When the fat man with the artificial hair tells you the same, he's letting you know a fast truth you can mark on a calendar. The only cure for it is cash, and they won't likely be holding any telethons for you. My friend Sid Youngers once said, "I've been very lucky with gambling. I've never won." And anybody with a gambling problem understands that statement, all right. First time I was ever in a casino, I was unlucky. I won, and I won big. Back in those days, Adam Egan drank, and he drank like a man. I don't know if he drank to remember or to forget, but boy, could he drink. We ordered 2 shots of Wild Turkey 101 and told the bartender to leave the bottle be. The bartender was rightly impressed. After we'd emptied the bottle, I hit the blackjack tables to bet my $5 a hand, and Adam Egan wandered onto the boardwalk, stumbling and muttering and telling anybody who would listen how he deserved much more than he had. The next time I saw him, my $300 bankroll was down to 180. "I met a gypsy," Adam Egan slurred. "What?" I asked, eager to get my next bet down. "I went to one of those fortune tellers to get my palm read." "I never figured you for one to believe in that horse shit." "I did it as a lark, as a gag. But here's the thing. The old woman, the gypsy, she looked at my palm and her face darkened, and she looked up at me with her black gypsy eyes, and my laugh got caught in my throat, and I wish I'd never had the idea for the lark, for the gag. She told me I was going to die, Norm. She told me I was going to die tonight." "Well, then how come I booked 2 rooms, I asked. And I laughed hard at my fine joke. And so did the dealer. But Adam Egan did not. He continued with a straight face. "She wants $100, and she'll give me a packet with some powder in it that I'm supposed to put under my pillow. If I do that, I won't die tonight." Well, can't you see she's making the whole thing up, Adam Egus? You'll be fine. That's what I thought. But when I went to bed, I couldn't sleep. Every time I closed my eyes, I saw the old gypsy's face and heard her words. I'm scared, Norm. You have to lend me $100. I'm losing money at this blackjack table, Adam Egget, and I won't indulge your silly superstitions. If you want $100, why don't you just jerk off 7 punks?
I told you about that in confidence, he said.
You did?
Yes, of course.
Oh, I thought everybody knew you jerked off punks underneath the Queensboro Bridge for $15 a man.
Don't say that anymore.
Okay, sorry. I didn't know you told me in confidence.
Don't you remember I was crying when I told you?
Sure I do, but I thought that's what you fellows do.
What do you mean, you fellows? I'm not gay, he said.
I stood corrected. I'll give you $12 for one, said the dealer, but not a penny more. Adam Egget looked at the dealer, and he appeared hurt.
Look, fellow, I don't do that stuff anymore. That was before, and this is now. And now I'm Norm's assistant. That's my job. And I need an advance. $100 advance.
As I was talking to Adam Egget, I'd lost another $35, and I got angry. Get away from me. It's still early, and if I end up winning, I'll give you $100 so you can pay the old gypsy. But until then, get out of here. With that, Adam Egget slunk away, whimpering. It put me in mind of a hyena. I changed tables and had a run of good luck. My bankroll was up to $250 now, and I was approaching even. This went on, and time passed, as it always does, since it knows no other way. 1 minute I was up, and the next I was down. When I only had $100 chip left, I took a break and walked around the casino. As I passed a craps table, a patron recognized me.
"Hey, you're somebody, aren't you?" a man holding 2 dice said.
"Sure I am," I said. "I'm Norm MacDonald, and I'm on the TV." This got everybody very excited, because they were just a bunch of nobodies who had TVs but were never on them. They insisted I play craps with them. But the problem was I'd never played the game and didn't know any of the rules. But I couldn't let these nobodies know that. "Sure, I'll play, and I'll win, too." The whole table of nobodies cheered, which made me feel good. The truth was that deep down, I felt like I was a nobody, too, just like them. Behind the craps table stood the pit boss, a handsome man, dressed in the most beautiful suit of clothes I'd ever seen. He was looking the picture of style and class, but I got the feeling that he was a dangerous man, and his beautiful clothes were designed to hide that fact, the way a shiny new violin case can conceal a machine gun. If you don't know the game of craps, here's how it works. As long as the fellow rolling the dice doesn't roll a 7, you stay alive. And when they hit your numbers, you win, and you can have as many as 6 different numbers. The minimum at the table was $25, so I put down my $100 chip to get change, but the man behind the table placed it on the pass line, and I was too embarrassed to correct him. It was all the money I had left. An Asian player rolled 5 or 6 times, and a 6 came up, and the pit boss gave me $120. "Press?" the man behind the table said. I didn't want to look like a know-nothing, so I said, "What do you think?" as if the answer was self-evident. I use that line a lot when I don't know what's going on. The man smiled, and now I had 220 down. From there on in, every one of my wins was automatically pressed. He only asked me that first time. Within 20 minutes, I had money on every number on the board, and within 40 minutes, I had a lot of money on every number. This Asian player, he didn't seem to know how to roll a 7, and my chip denominations had climbed from the original $5 chip to a $1,000 chip. And finally, at about the hour mark, I was playing with the maximum $5,000 chip. The funny thing is, the $5 chip was the very same size as the $5,000 chip. Probably cost the same to make, but it was worth
1,000 times more. I was winning big time now. I began to feel an extraordinary transformation taking place deep within me, one that mirrored my chip's transformation, for I felt myself double in value and then redouble and press to the maximum. I was the exact same size physically, and yet I was worth much more, 1,000 times more. And that lingering suspicion that I might be a nobody was long gone. The Asian player rolled for 20 more minutes, and finally he rolled a 7 and the run was over. Everyone cheered, and I had $118,000 in chips. I colored up, threw a $50 tip on the table, and left in perfect calm and elation, big as God inside, blessed on this Sunday in the unlikeliest of places. I walked onto the boardwalk, my heart and pockets full. The people around me all looked small, and I knew that I was once like them, but now I was different. Same on the outside, maybe, but 1,000 times as bright, 1,000 times as powerful, 1,000 times what they were. I saw the blackjack dealer I had first sat with and lost $120 to. "Remember me?" I asked. "Sure, I remember you," the dealer said, and I noticed he was zipping up his trousers. "Your friend's over there, and he's $12 richer." I walked over and saw Adam Egan, and he was on a bench weeping. When he saw me, he fell to the ground and clutched at my ankles. "Norm, please, I need you to punch me in the face," he said. "Don't be ashamed, Adam Egan," I said. "A man must do what he can to make a living in this world, and sometimes life can be a hard, hard coin." "No, I need you to punch me in the face so I can sell my gold fillings. It's nearly midnight, and I am very afraid." "Don't worry," I laughed. "I am blessed by God himself this Sabbath, and you will not die tonight." And as I said that, I carefully counted out $88 worth of chips and tossed them down on the boardwalk, and Adam Egan got on his hands and knees as they clattered around, searching them all out in the dark, and then he kissed my feet and ran to find the old gypsy.
I awoke with a plan. I hesitate to call it my own plan, since it did not exist when I fell asleep the previous evening. It was as if another man had spent months conniving and creating the plan, and then had come to me as I slept and staged it whole in my mind. For 3 weeks now, an enfeebling depression has fastened me to my bed. The house painter has been rejected by every publishing house in the city. I'd expected a bidding war, but I hadn't even received an opening salvo. When the rejection letters first began appearing in my mailbox, I was amused, and I felt sorry for each poor chap who had passed on my masterpiece and would certainly one day lose his job over the decision. But as the rejection letters kept coming, despondency fell upon me. Was it possible that the years of transcribing lame anecdotes of marginal celebrities had atrophied my skills to the point where my real writing was unpublishable? My first anxiety came with the silence of Julie Grau. I thought perhaps she hadn't received the manuscript, so I put another in the mail, and a week later sat in shock over a cup of coffee while I read an unsigned form letter from Random House. I rang Julie up. "Oh, Terence, how lovely of you to call. What's wrong with it?" "Your novel? Well, to tell you the truth, I simply haven't had the time to read it. I just got back from..." "What's wrong with it?" A long silence followed. "There's nothing wrong with it, Terence. It's really quite charming. Have you considered self-publishing?" A much longer silence followed. "Terence, how is the Norm MacDonald book coming along?" I threw the phone through my window. And that is what put me in my bed and kept me there, eating Haagen-Dazs and Kit Kats, Milky Ways and Twix, drinking Mexican Cokes, watching Bewitched, and falling asleep, and waking up, and falling asleep again. But this morning, I awoke with the plan. I bounced to the floor, showered, shaved, and put on my best shirt. I carefully read my novel as if I had never written it. I had to be sure, absolutely sure. I have just finished the last line, and I am as certain as ever. It is pitch perfect. And now I put a fresh page in the old Underwood and begin composing another work. Although the task of writing has always been a laborious process for me, there is no tedium this time. The words come easy and very fast. Perhaps I have found a genre perfectly suited to my skills. The suicide note.
Chapter 40, Flipping Coins. I've been convalescing in this suite in the Tropicana for about a week now. I got the same one I got almost 20 years ago, for the luck. Most of my purple flesh has turned yellow, and that means I'll be able to move soon. I relax in my big hotel bed as I reflect on my life and career. This turns out to be a huge mistake. Anxiety begins to crawl across my motionless body like a spider. So instead, I begin to reflect on the life and career of Adam Sandler. This calms me. Adam Egget comes busting into my room. "Hey, great news! Sammy is flying out. She'll be here tomorrow morning." I hate when people say they have good news and then they don't. "Oh, yeah, Sammy, the lady who's definitely not a dude. So, she's flying all the way out here, huh?" "Yeah, we're pretty serious, Norm. I think I'm in love with her. I'm thinking of asking her to move into my place." "But you don't even have a place." "Well, yeah. Don't tell Sammy, though." Our trip has cost Adam Egget his apartment and his job, but it will all soon be over, and he'll be a ranch hand in Montana, and the head ranch hand, too. I haven't told him yet, but I plan on buying him a hat. A cowboy hat. Adam Egget is very excited that Sammy is on her way. He grabs a handful of nickels from my Video Kino nickel jar and runs from the room like a boy in search of gumballs. The next morning, I sit in the coffee shop and chat with the two of them. I remind them that the first time they met was in a Las Vegas coffee shop. They find this to be the most hilarious coincidence, and Sammy giggles, and Adam Egget hugs her and beams pride. "Tell me, Sammy," I say, "what do you do for a living?" "I'm a plumber." "Isn't she the cutest?" Adam Egget asks. "Listen, honey, you want to come watch me play Video Kino? I'm up 85 cents. "Oh, my God, Video Kino is my favorite game," Sammy says. "What are the chances?" I agree. The chances are a billion to one. Maybe these two are made for each other after all. The happy couple leave arm in arm, and I finally have some peace and quiet to consider my betting strategy. Here's the thing about the tables. In order to have the best chance at winning, you should take your entire bankroll and bet it all on a hand of blackjack, or a round of craps. The thinking is that the house edge becomes more certain the more hands you play. The less you play, the less you're against it. Simple as that. I would have bet the whole million in a heartbeat, if it was permitted. New Jersey law allows you to count cards, but the casinos continually reshuffle the deck, so it renders card counting worthless. I would have to wager the maximum $5,000 at all times and simply hope to get lucky. Before my first session, I go to the restroom and splash cold water on my face. The sight of Sammy, with her neon pink lipstick and drum-tight skirt, has unsettled me. I am beginning to feel sorry for my friend. This romance will not end well. I'm 2 hours in now. I began my night with craps, and I've recently switched over to blackjack. Running a good shoe, playing $5,000 a hand, three hands at once, and I am up somewhere near $200,000. Suddenly I hear a huge commotion, and the dealer says, "Somebody hit it big over by the bar. Hey, you ever play the slots?" "Oh, all the time. I mean, that's the smart play," I say, with unconcealed disdain. I'd heard that siren so often over the years, the hoots and the hollers. It's the sound of dumb luck, and it always made me angry as hell. Where is the justice? Some idiot risks nothing, plays a low-stake slot machine, and is awarded a fortune. Well, I risk huge money,
with no chance at a jackpot. A moment later, I see Adam Egan and the woman he is in love with running toward me, laughing and clutching a ticket. I didn't even have to pick any numbers, Norm. As soon as I put my nickel in, there was all this ringing, and it seemed to last forever, and then this ticket came out. He shows me the video Keno ticket, and I can't breathe. It reads $2.6 million. I am saved. I sit at a table betting $5,000 a hand, but I am saved by a squid with a nickel. I am holding $1.2 million, and Adam Egan holds $2.6. I do the math quickly. We owe $2 million, and we hold $3.8. That's a profit of 1.8 million smackaroos. The journey is over. It all started on a black, silent stage at the world-famous Comedy Store, and now it ends in the same bright casino where I saved Adam Egan from the spell of an evil gypsy. And now, the self-same Adam Egan stands before me. He has paid off his debt. He has saved my life. And then I hear her voice. Let's go cash it in, honey bear. We're rich. We're rich. Sammy, I say, could I have a moment with my friend? She looks at me with suspicion, and I can see she's mulling it over, trying to find the smart play. Finally, she says, sure thing, Mac, and gives Adam Egan a kiss before grudgingly walking a dozen feet away. Wow, I say, I knew you could do it. I believed in you, and you didn't let me down. Best investment I ever made. What do you mean, Norm? Nothing. Just that it was my nickel that you used to win the ticket. Therefore, it's my ticket. Oh, dang, he says, and sighs deeply. I thought I had won something really big. For the first time in my life, I felt like a winner. Oh, no, not at all. You're still not a winner, I say, and I snatch the ticket from him. I return to playing blackjack, but every moment or so, my hand touches the magic ticket in my shirt pocket. I try to act natural as I play $5 hands, the way I used to nearly 20 years ago. But the corner of my eye remains closely on Adam Egan and Sammy. His shoulders are slouched, and his movements are slow, but Sammy is animated, and her hands are gesticulating wildly. Suddenly, Sammy strikes him across the face, and she follows it up with what looks like a long and angry speech, a speech she punctuates by frequently jabbing her finger hard into his chest. When she is done, she points at me, then slams the heel of her hand into his back, and he stumbles forward and slinks over to where I sit. His right cheek has a big red paw print on it. Hey, Norm, I was thinking about it, and we never really had any deal worked out, and after all, it was me who won the jackpot, and I have a whole bunch of witnesses. Now, you listen to me, Adam Egan. When you talk about witnesses, you're talking about a court of law. And if that's where you want to take this, fine. But who do you think a jury would side with? You or a guy who's been on the TV? He looks at me, and then at Sammy. And I can tell he doesn't want to go back to Sammy without the ticket. So I have to continue. Put yourself in the jurors' minds. Do they believe the guy who has starred in two motion pictures and is a close personal friend of Adam Sandler? Or the guy who jerked off punks underneath the Queensboro Bridge for $15 a man? Adam Egan looks at me plaintively. You promised you'd never bring that up. Please, never tell Sammy that. She's very old-fashioned. She wouldn't understand. Of course I would never bring that up. But in a court of law, under oath, made with my hand upon the Holy Bible, I'd have no choice. And they'd probably televise the trial. I'm just glad your mom doesn't have a TV. Sweat appears in a mist on Adam Egan's forehead, and he gulps for air. But she does have a TV, Norm. She has two. Well, don't worry. I'll figure this out. You just go and tell Sammy that I want to take you guys to the best restaurant in town tonight, where we will discuss this like gentlemen. I mean, two gentlemen and a lady. But for now, you tell her to go to the spa and relax. Then you come back here, and I will have a big surprise for you.
I place my chips in front of me, but once again look at Adam Egott and his true love from my eye's corner. She still appears very angry, but finally relents and leaves. Adam Egott returns. So, what's the big surprise? I take him over to the cage and toss a black chip to the teller. Give this man 2,000 nickels, I say. Adam Egott is dumbstruck. No way, 2,000? That's right. And what's more, from now on I want us to be partners in this video, Kino. You clearly have a feel for the game. Next time you hit the jackpot, you keep all the money. Then the next time, I keep all the money. And so on. What do you say? Partners? I've never seen him so happy. He sticks out his big baseball mitt of a hand, and we shake on it. I turn back to the teller and toss her another black chip. Another 2,000 nickels for my friend. I believe in this man. The teller is very annoyed, but Adam Egott is deeply moved. Now all I have to worry about is Sammy. That evening at dinner, Sammy makes her intentions clear. The ticket is to be returned to Adam Egott or the police would be involved. Adam Egott looks from Sammy to me and back again, like a dog afraid of getting beat. I have to say something, so I do. I'll tell you what, I'm a fair man. How about we split it down the middle? We each get $1.3 million. Think about it, Sammy. That's big money. That'll buy a lot of women's clothing. Yeah, Adam Egott says. And imagine the ring we can get. He turns to me. Norm, I want you to be the first to know I have asked Sammy to marry me, and she has said yes and made me the happiest man in the world. Gross, I say. Sammy stands up, all 6'4" of her. Excuse me? What did you just say? No. I was just saying these French fries are gross. I'll be having a word with the chef about this. But first, let me congratulate you two kids. I'm sure you'll be so happy together. Now, about this ticket. Don't you think we'd be best off just splitting the money? If we take this to a courthouse, they'll have all kinds of questions about our pasts and our work history and our gender. Sammy studies me for some time, and I begin to worry that she'll take her chances in court. Finally, she speaks. Okay, this is how it's going to go down. We cash the ticket together in front of everybody. And just so there's no funny business, I'm phoning a friend of mine, a lawyer who lives in Philly. She'll be here by tomorrow. Oh, that sounds fine, Sammy, I say. Come on, Adam Egott, let's you and me get some rest. And I get up to go, but she stops me. There's one thing left to discuss, she says. Who holds the ticket? Oh, I'll hold the ticket, I say. No, says Sammy. Not you. Adam is the only one we both trust. He is going to place the ticket in the safe in your room and use a combination that only he knows. When my lawyer friend shows up, we'll open the safe and go to the cashier. We all go back to my room where we make a big production of putting the ticket into the safe, which takes much longer than it should, because Adam Egott can't think of a, quote, good number. When he finally settles on one, Sammy grabs him by the ear and leaves the room. Until tomorrow morning, you stay with me. She thinks that she's got me. So I play along, looking mighty disappointed that I can't be with the man with the combo. But I have other ideas. Then I return to the blackjack table. I hit a run of some bad luck, but I'm betting $5 a hand, so it's actually very good luck. Besides, I'm only there to kill a little time, and as soon as I feel I'm not being watched, I cash out and go find Andre, my host. When you lose as much as I do gambling, you can get a lot. And besides, the room is in my name, and my name only. It's a fairly simple request. I just tell Andre I've run out of money and forgotten the combination to my safe. Andre summons an engineer, and the three of us proceed to my room. When we walk in, I see Adam Egott on the floor. His hands and feet are bound with rope, and he has duct tape on his mouth. I tear it off. The wedding's off, Norm. What? I'm not marrying the only woman I ever loved. And you want to know why?
Well, I'll tell you, because she's not a woman, that's why. She's a man. She showed me right to my face, very close to my face. Don't worry, you're better off. But I loved her, Norm. I loved her more than anything in life, and she broke my heart and took the ticket. I know it hurts now, Adam Egitt, and I know it feels like the pain will never go away. But the funny thing about love is... The ticket! The ticket? What do you mean, the ticket? I gave her the combination. She told me that if I didn't, she would beat me up. I don't care about the ticket, Norm. I loved her, and now she's gone forever. I don't want to go on living. Problem is, I do. I get down to the floor as fast as I can and get to the cashier's cage and ask if she's been seen. I'm told she was here, but cashed the ticket, filled out all the necessary paperwork, and was gone. I can file a police report, I am told, but people like Sammy are hard to find, and I don't have a lot of time. I think that if I go back to my room, I might kill Adam Egitt. So instead, I return to the blackjack tables. I need to win. I am alone at the table and playing all the spots, $5,000 each. I am playing smart and patient. It takes me nearly 6 hours before I bust. Better luck next time, sir. The familiar gloom of losing everything falls upon me, and I wander the floor, alone and lost. As I pass the cashier's cage, I hear a ruckus, and look over and see a man in a loud argument with the cashier. I move in close, and when I do, I recognize the man. It is Adam Egitt, reeking of cheap gin, and trying to cash in his 5-year chip. Chapter 41, After the Fall. We sit in the Tropicana coffee shop, not drinking coffee. I drink warm whiskey, and Adam Egitt drinks cold, cold gin. Now that all hope is gone, a deep relief has taken its place, and I allow myself to enjoy it before the despair sets in. Adam Egitt tells me that he has just gotten off the phone with the Comedy Store, and that Pauly Shore said he could return as manager. He tells me that he is going to quit drinking again, and this time for good. He says maybe he will find a girl, a real girl, and settle down. Sure, I say. Everything will work out just fine. But the truth is, I have less hope for Adam Egitt than I do for myself. My phone rings, and the voice on the other end sounds familiar. Tough last hand, Norm. But you got to split eights, right? Even against an ace. Yeah, that's what the book says. I'm starting to get scared. 10,000 a week, Norm. First month's free. Well, that did it fast. The face came to me immediately, with its crocodile teeth and doornail eyes. The voice on the line was the fat man with the artificial hair. I downed my drink and yelled loudly for another. He already knows Adam Egitt. God knows how, but he already knows. I gotta get 10,000, and I've got less than 3 weeks. Oh, that guy. Yeah, well, I don't want to say I told you so, but I always felt those terms were a mite steep. And what if by some miracle you managed to scrounge together $10,000? What's that buy you? Another 7 days of life, that's all. Now that Adam Egitt was a stinking drunk again, he was making a lot more sense. But I have no other choice. This is the bed I made, and it's the bed I must now lie in. But Adam Egitt is calm. What if I were to tell you that you could pay him the whole million all at once, and you just have to do one thing? What is it, I say? What do I have to do? Adam Egitt relaxes his body backward against the booth, swallowing a mouthful of cold, cold gin, and speaks. Finish the book.
I like having no phone and a phone-shaped hole in the window. The apartment can get pretty windy at night, but it doesn't bother me. Nothing has bothered me since the day I awoke with the plan. It's just so perfectly rational. As you can see, I'm not a romantic, no great writer is. But The Public is a different story. A posthumous work can be highly appealing. a book that took 20 years to write, which was then summarily and callously rejected, causing its author to take his own life? Now that is downright irresistible. Add to this that the manuscript in question is top-notch literature, and we have the makings of a tragedy. By ending my life, I will live forever. The only decision left to make is the manner of the self-murder. Pills seem like the simplest out, but there is something about the rope that is just so classic. We'll see. I will finish this note and then finish myself.
Chapter 42, A Fancy Name for a Filthy Thing. Atlantic City hurt us all, and that included the White Challenger. While I convalesced in a hospital, the car was being made whole in a body shop. Now it's hidden in an alley behind Keene's apartment, and we are bounding up the fire escape and busting through Keene's door. As soon as we get in the room, a wind hits us, and Adam Egott points to the window, where a telephone-size hole explains everything. The couch is covered with candy bar wrappers and empty ice cream cartons and my bum of a secretary, fast asleep. Beside him is a pill bottle, tipped on its side with pills spilled everywhere. "Wake up, Keene," I say, loud and right in his ear. "Where is my book?" Adam Egott and I start ransacking the apartment in search of the book, and lucky for us, Keene has a bookcase, so that's where we start. I figure out that he's been busy writing all right. It turns out he's been doing his secretary work for a lot of guys, and we go through every last one of them. There's a book by a guy named J.D. Salinger. I think he was a middleweight back in the day, but most I've never heard of. William Faulkner, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, William S. Burroughs. There's one by Victor Hugo. I remember him. He was the bearded one who won Survivor the first year. Anyways, the point is, Keene has been busy writing for all these clowns. But we go through every single book, and mine isn't here. Mine isn't here! I get mad as hell and start yelling in Keene's ear, and finally he's awake and starts in with his "now see here, and I'll have you know," and all the rest of that splendid talk of his. "You'll be surprised to know that I have other projects, Mr. McDonald, but I understand your concern. The deadline is imminent, and I promise I will have it done." "You should have just told Hugo to wait his turn. Nobody cares about him anyway. He was from season one, wasn't he?" And I can hear my words getting louder and angrier, but the truth is I'm scared. "And let's get serious, Keene. Hell, how hard can this be? I mean, don't I phone every few days and tell you lots of stories? All you have to do is type them. Did you get my story about how I had my very own show, and then I wanted to call it the Big Boss Man, and they wanted to call it the Norm Show, and how they gave me my very own show but refused to give me a gun? Did you not get that one? I called it in 2 days ago and must have talked for an hour on your answering machine. That's got to be good for a chapter or two." "Yes, I listened to it. And frankly, I didn't understand a word of it." "Now you listen to me, old man. It's not your job to frankly understand a word of it. It's your job to type down the words you frankly don't understand and to put them in a book. We got to hand it to that grow brat over at Random House. Get our cash." "Yes, I understand how the process works." And now it's Keene whose voice takes on an angry edge. We are really starting to shout each other down now, but just when I think it's sure to come to fists, Keene stops, and a faraway look comes upon his eyes, and he smiles. "Yes. Yes, now that I think of it, you're quite right, Mr. McDonald. Well, there's no reason I shouldn't be able to finish this book within that time, what with all the fine material you've been providing me?" "Certainly, yes. There's just one thing I must insist on. One thing, and I hope it doesn't come off rude. It's just that I mustn't be disturbed, you understand. My work demands solitude. You boys look exhausted. Why don't you get yourself some sleep, and I'll get right to work. What do you say, fellows?" This turnaround by Keene gets me excited, and I lead him over to the desk where his computer sits. But then, when I look over at Adam Egott, I see the tears, so I take the smile off my face. I know the problem, of course, and approach him. You're thinking about Sammy, aren't you? Yeah, I am, he says. You know, Norm, I don't know which hurts more. The knowledge that I'll never feel her lips against mine, or the knowledge that she was a man who stole my $1.6 million video kino ticket. For me, it would be the second one. Really? Oh, yeah, the second one, for sure. You're a good friend, Norm. Better than you think, I say. And pull out a bottle of 150-proof iceberg rum. Go into Keene's room, drink down this bottle, and get some shut-eye. You need it, buddy. And Adam Egget smiles at the sight of Edward McClintock's bottle and grabs it by the throat like a bad man, and the two of them retire to the bedroom. I turn my attention back to Keene, who is sitting in front of his computer but not looking at it. Instead, his gaze falls somewhere in the middle distance, where reality resides. Oh, I don't mean to be inhospitable, but you boys aren't thinking of staying here with me, are you? Sure we are, I say. Listen, what do you say I sit beside you so we can hurry this up? I'll do the talking and you do the typing, and I bet we'll be finished by the morning. It looks like my words have snapped Keene out of his trance. No need, my good man, no need at all. Now, you could do something to help, though. Yeah, sure, Keene, anything at all. The thing is, there's been quite a draft here in the parlor ever since the telephone left. I've been helping myself to your clothes. As I explained to you, I'm a method writer. But the thing is, the outfit has gotten a little gamey. Yeah, yeah, sure. Keene always did take a long time to ask a short question. I grab a Norm Show t-shirt, an SNL jacket, and a dirty work cap for my suitcase. Mr. McDonald, I can't help but notice the stitching on your SNL jacket. Oh, yeah, I say. The first shipment I bought, the damn fool wrote my name as Norm McFonald. But he gave them to me half price, and I figured maybe they'd have antique value one day. I got 10 like that, never wear them, so you help yourself to one. They're practically brand new. You'll be wearing a genuine collector's item, Keene. Well, thank you very much, Mr. McFonald. I guess that's Keene's idea of a joke. Yeah, no problem at all. There are 9 more where that came from. How's that sound? Keene smiles. It sounds splendid, he says, and then flinches. I just smile at the old man. He's not so bad. He insists he will have the book finished by the morning, but only if I leave him alone. He says I can sleep in his room, and when I look back, Keene is already hard at work, so I hit the hay and fall fast asleep, happy that when I wake up the book will be finished, or close to it. But I wake up in the middle of the night, when nature calls. I get up and take a visit to the little boy's room, and when I walk out of Keene's bedroom, I see something I will likely never forget. There stands Keene, fully dressed in my clothes, on top of a small stepladder with a noose around his neck. He sees me, and I can see the shock register on his face. He's been caught. Still, he is determined. Mr. McDonald, might I suggest that you go back to your room? This is not something you want to see. You're damn right it's not, I say. But it's not something you want to do either, Keene. Think about it. You slip at all and lose your footing on that stepladder, and you're a dead man. Things become worse when I look across the room and see Adam Egget and his PJs looking on in confusion. You guys woke me up. Hey, what's Mr. Keene doing, Norm? I look at him in his pajamas and his innocence. It's called autoerotic asphyxiation, Adam Egget. No, no, no. What? Protests Keene. What's autoerotic asphyxiation, Norm? Well, it's a very fancy name for a very filthy thing. That's not what's going on here, says Keene. Oh, no, of course not. You were changing a light bulb, I'm sure. With a noose around your neck. Look, I'm warning you two, just return to your rooms and go to sleep. If you stay, you're not going to like what you see. Duh, I say. Look, if you're hell-bent on doing this thing that only serves to make a filthy thing filthier, then fine.
but it is the responsibility of my friend and me to make sure nothing goes wrong. The last thing I want is to try to explain to your friends and family in the press what we witnessed here tonight. Adam Egott, steady the ladder while he deprives himself of oxygen and lays down with himself simultaneously. Something in my book must have filled him with impure thoughts. "Stop this babble," Keen blares, and then removes the noose from his neck. "I've decided against it." "You're making a wise decision, Keen, and I'll reward you for it." I pull a capsule of amyl nitrate from my pocket. "You go now and lay beside yourself, and at the moment of sin, break this beneath your nose and inhale deeply. It'll do the trick just fine. No rope necessary." Keen throws the capsule with contempt to the floor, and it bounces once on the hardwood and vanishes beneath the couch. Immediately, Adam Egott is on his hands and knees, with his head underneath the couch, searching for the amyl nitrate, as a swine would truffles. "I suppose you're right, Mr. MacDonald," Keen hisses as I make my way to the little boy's room. "I promised Ms. Grau a manuscript, and I must honor that promise." And, as if in a trance, he trundles over to his computer and sits before it.
I've been biding my time, and now is my chance. I wake up to find MacDonald gone and the other one asleep. Mr. MacDonald has been keeping me captive for a month now. I've been here typing what he says, getting as many words down as possible. The other one has a gun trained on me at all times. They are hiding, they say, from the fat man with the artificial hair, and they might well be. This fat man with the artificial hair may well kill us all. There is a problem, though. He may not exist. I may have made him up. I can't be sure of anything anymore. In order to fill up Mr. MacDonald's memoirs, I had to stray far from the prosaic facts that made up his life, and I have veered into straight-out falsehoods. Why would these fools have barricaded themselves in my brownstone if there was not real danger outside? And what about the dolt sleeping on the couch? The one I named Adam Egott. He never existed before I constructed him on my own computer. He does not exist in the real world. He has never managed the world-famous comedy store. I know I made him up. But how is it that I could have made up a human being who now lies snoring on my Chesterfield? No, this is the truth. I am a secretary, just as Mr. MacDonald has asserted from the beginning. I know that the two live here with me and that they are on the lam. I know this is true and not something I have written. And I know what I need to find MacDonald's essence. I've known it from the start. I tie a band around my biceps, pick up a serrette, place the needle in the crook of my arm, and push hard, just like I've seen Mr. MacDonald do, sending a triple shot of morphine into my blood. It feels just like happiness. I pick up the gun from where it lies beneath the couch, and I make for the door. Before I leave, I look in the mirror and am confronted by a slovenly fool. My eyes have gone blank, just like his. I am stunned for a moment. It has finally happened. I have become him. Oh, God, help me. I have become him.
Chapter 43, Escape. I strike Adam Egott awake, and he whimpers and asks where he is and who I am and all those questions men ask when they are awoken suddenly. Where's Keen? We said we would take turns guarding him, and now he's gone. I must have fallen asleep. I punch him directly in the nose, right in that spot that makes the blood come out fast and full. And Adam Egott covers his nose with his hands and runs crying to the bathroom. I'm very scared now. Keen wasted too much time, and the 30-day limit has come and gone. The red Cadillac has been parked across the street for a week now, and some goons knocked on the door a few days ago. Adam Egott and I listened from the closet as Keen answered a few questions, and the goons moved on. Since then, there's been nothing. But they know we're in the building. I hope Keen remembered that when he left. If he was smart, he took the fire escape and then ducked through the kitchen of the Chinese restaurant to 6th Avenue and beyond. But he's been acting screwy lately. Reckless. Sometimes he'll open the curtain in front of the window with the hole in it, sending Adam Egget and me diving behind furniture. Because we can still see the big red Cadillac across the street. Does he really think he has a chance against the fat man with the artificial hair? I reach under the couch for my gun. It's gone. Where the hell did I leave it? I can't go out in New York City unarmed. Keene has a whole bunch of baseball gloves and balls and bats signed by famous players. He's got so many you'd think he was a baseball player himself. I grab the biggest bat I can find, signed by Lou Gehrig. It's not much of a weapon, but it's all I got, and I have no time. I have to find Keene, and find him fast.
I order a glass of Wild Turkey 101 and ask the waiter to leave the bottle. I never had much tolerance for libations, but I am determined to go through with this transformation as far as I can. And I see now that the drink has little effect on me, the morphine has numbed me out, and the liquor does not burn my gullet. It's like my insides are as impervious as ice. When I talk, and I do feel like talking a lot on this drug, my voice is a slur, thick and incoherent, and I smile and laugh for little reason. It takes only a moment for someone to recognize the voice. "Hey, I know you!" And he's over on me in a moment and has me in a headlock. "You're that guy," he says, leading me to the table where his friends are sitting. "Hey, you know who this guy is?" I can't tell if the question is rhetorical or genuine. One couple there clearly has no idea, but they seem polite enough about it, even a little apologetic. But in the other five, I see that their eyes are narrowed in on me, and they look from me to a place down on the table or on the wall where their memories are just out of reach. "I seen you in something," offers one. "Sure you have," I say. "Where have I seen you?" Luckily, I have become a bit of an expert on who I am, so I decide to guess from their age how they might know me. "Well, you may have heard of a little movie called Billy Madison." "You're not Adam Sandler," one punk sneers dismissively. "Maybe not, but I know him, and he knows me too." "Then get him on the phone." "I would, but not to the likes of you." "Then just tell us how we know you." "Take it easy, Charlie. After all, I invited him over here." This one is the biggest and the youngest, and I can tell that he has a dangerous bite to him. But the fine morphine has me immune to my usual fear of the young. "You ever heard of the Norm Show?" "Nope." "I played Norm." "You ever been on television?" "Are you not even listening? I've been on every talk show there is, Jimmy Fallon, Conan, Kimmel, Leno, even the grand old man himself, David Letterman, and always as the first guest, too." I can feel the pride swelling me up, and I take another fine, free shot of booze. This is turning out okay. As long as these folks don't figure out where they almost know me from, they have no choice. Everything is free. So I decide to let the mystery play out, and then I'll let them in on the fine secret, and we'll all have a good laugh and talk about the great merriment I've brought into each of their banal lives. The one they call Fred says, "I'm sorry, I never watch TV." You can tell he isn't sorry at all, but proud and probably lying to boot, and I feel my hand turn to a fist under the table. I spend my whole life trying to get on TV, and it just isn't enough for this son of a bitch of a Fred. Then one of the bigger rogues gets an impatient look to him, like my life isn't worth the time of a parlor game. "Look, just tell us where we know you from. We got girls coming over here to meet us soon. We don't have all day." "I guess they must have got lost in traffic, huh?" I say, and recognize the line from my audience interaction on those thousands of tapes back at the brownstone. This gets me my first laugh from the table, and it gives me the idea that maybe one of these boys has seen me perform live, in the flesh. So I give it a thought. Who am I, anyway? I've always felt a man is what a man does, so I give them the truth. I've done stand-up comedy across this country and Canada as well for nearly 30 years, and I continue to do it to this very day. I have to snort back a laugh because it sounds like one of them game show questions where you follow it up with, "Who am I?" "You know Louis C.K.? You know Amy Schumer? You know Aziz Ansari? You know Bill Burr?" "I know them all, goddammit, and they know me too. I met Louis C.K. once." "We saw Aziz at Carnegie Hall. You ever play Carnegie Hall?" "I don't like big rooms. I play clubs. It's more intimate." "Yeah, I bet you like it real intimate." I can't tell if this last one is a dig at the size of the venues I play or the more squalid obvious. Either way, I've already accepted that I am in the company of Philistines. The piling on has brought out the best in one of the fellows, though, and he pushes a brown plastic bowl of bar snacks in my direction. I was at the cellar last night and I saw Colin Quinn. You know him? Now you're getting closer. I nearly burst out of my seat and realized for the first time it is becoming important to me that one of these young men solve this puzzle. Yeah, me and Colin go way back, and if you know Colin Quinn, there's a good chance you know me too. And then it happened.